All right, Parsha Power, Parshas Noach, Baruch Hashem, back in the Beis Medrash. And we have, like in the beginning of the series, we did Rishis last week, but I did that by myself in a room alone, which was very lonely. But now we are together again in the Beis Medrash doing Parshas Noach. And like last week, I have seven sections for Parshas Noach, even though I think Noach could have been stretched to a bunch of segments. But I decided to put everything included in the Mabul. I did this last year also. Everything in the Mabul is one section, even though obviously the Mabul is made up of a bunch of Parshios, and then there's a lot of repetition within the Mabul, and there are a lot of Parshios that make up the Mabul, but I put it all as one section. But even though the Mabul is probably the most famous thing about the Parsha, it's not the only thing in the Parsha, which drives the question that we always ask, and that is, what is the Parsha as a whole about? The Mabul is obviously the biggest part, but what is Parshas Noach? On the map of Parshios, what does Noach do? What does it accomplish? What would you say?
It sounds like, it's like sort of like setting the groundwork for Abraham to come onto the scene.
Okay, great. So it's setting. So I think that's definitely at least half of the Parsha, because right, we know that. I can maybe elaborate a little bit more. How is it setting the stage for Abraham?
I mean, because
I think you're right.
Yeah. I mean, like, besides the fact that we're counting the 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, that's, like, sort of the most obvious. Mm-hmm. But also, like, just seeing some of, like, the faults of the people that, you know, first they go through a Mabul, and then there's a Hafluga, and then finally there comes out this person, Abraham, that saves the entire world, as the Rambam says.
Okay, excellent. So, yeah, we are looking at the deterioration of mankind. And this is something that we spoke about last week in Bereishis as well. That if you look at what really is Bereishis, so you might be inclined to say, well, Bereishis is the story of creation. And I would tell you, well, yes, but if Bereishis would be just the story of creation, then really the first aliyah should have really been broken down to seven aliyahs. That should have been the first parsha. It does not end with, you know, Hashem creating Shabbos on day seven. It actually goes all the way. We meet Adam and Chava, we meet Cain and Hevel, and we meet the Dor Enosh, sort of a little bit in the Midrash and help a little more with that. And then we have the Bnei Elohim and the Bnei Sadam. But what's the whole point? That Bereishis takes us from the beginning, the genesis of mankind and Hashem's creation of the world. And how does the Parsha end? The book ends of the Parsha. It's interesting that I mentioned this last week, that Hashem looks at the world in the beginning of creation. He looks at everything keto mode, everything is good. At the very end, Vayara Hashem Ki Rabba Sadon Baretz, Hashem sees everything his entire masterpiece was ruined. So the beginning of the Parsha is Hashem's creation of the world. The end is how mankind had destroyed Hashem's world. And that's what led us into Parshas Noach, that Hashem is going to destroy the world. So that would lead us to believe that at least the beginning of Noach, right? The point that we said was that Parshas Noach is setting the stage for Abram. That's certainly what it accomplishes on the global scale. But that what about well before Abram? Because we start Parshas Noach 20 generations before Abraham. Or, sorry, 10 generations before Abraham. Beginning of Bereishis is 24. So we are 10 generations before Abraham. So, was it, like, obviously it wasn't supposed to take 10 generations. Hashem knows what's going to happen and all of that. But, it wasn't like Hashem said, okay, Noach, I'm putting you on the world, and thereby, we're going to, 10 generations later, there's going to be an Abraham. That wasn't the goal, obviously. So Noach was... even though Parshas Noach gets us to Abraham, but the Hava Amina of Parshas Noach is that Noach is plan B for creation, he's plan B for mankind. So when we meet Noach, at least in the beginning of Parshas Noach and really at the end of Parshas Bereishis, we are looking at what's supposed to be plan B for Hashem's model of the world, Hashem's creation of the world. That would be Noach. That's why Hashem is destroying the world, and then there's going to be Noach. But between Noach and Abraham, in those 10 generations, we learn that Noach wasn't exactly going to be it. He maybe should have been it, but he wasn't it. And this goes back to all the Chazals that we talk about, you know, how Noach is pretty enigmatic in that, you know, on the one hand he's a tzaddik, and on the other hand he's not the tzaddik, he's not, or maybe for that generation he was the tzaddik, but he wasn't the you know, he wasn't like Abraham, and Van Berger spoke a lot about that. And, you know, the Svarim pour out all over it. But the point is, for whatever reason, Noach wasn't the one. And then, and of course, there was, and as you mentioned, that there was the Dor HaPlaga, which, by the way, if you look in some of the Svarim, they pronounce the Dor HaPlaga. But I know, okay, in Yeshivas, everyone says Plaga. And I'm going to say Dor HaPlaga for convenience, but and, in the Ramban, I saw him, and I guess on another Svarim, they put the punctuation and said Dor HaPlaga, or Palaga. Either way. But the point is that we see within these generations that there were problems, and mankind still hadn't gotten it together, even after Hashem destroyed the world. But what is Parshas Noach? It's the destruction and the recreation of Hashem's world. It's Hashem's plan B for the world, and the intro to Hashem's plan C for the world. That was Abraham. So we have plan B, the plan B, and the seeds of plan C. Okay. Now, so let's talk about the specifics of the parsha. So, number one for the parsha is the Mabul. It's all the introduction to the Mabul, and excluding the introduction that took place in Bereishis. There was an intro there. There's an intro here. Last year we spoke a little bit about two introductions to the Mabul, because we have an introduction here, we have one in Bereishis. I'm not going to elaborate on it so much right now. If you want, I could send you last year's Noach and hear all about that. But we have the introduction this week's parsha to the Mabul. We have Noach building the Teva. We have the span of the Mabul, and Noach getting all the animals. Fine. That, all that's Mabul, the Yonah, the Arev, so all that's in section one, the Mabul. Number two is everything post-Mabul. Not everything post-Mabul, but the things that were immediately following the Mabul. We have Hashem's bris with Noah. That's Noah bringing a carbon. This is Hashem saying, you're not allowed to kill things, and animals, even if they kill, there's going to be a reckoning for them. And we have the rainbow. Hashem's not going to destroy the world again. That's all section two, Hashem's bris with Noah. Section three, we have Noach in the Kerem, Noach in the vineyard. Very also enigmatic story with Chum, and somehow Canaan is involved. Chum's fourth son, Noach is drunk. We know the story. Fine. Number four, we start to get lineage. We get lineage of Yafes, Chum, and Shem. We hear about all of their families and all of their lineage. Five, we get to another enigmatic story. A lot of these stories is just a lot of information that seems to be missing, and they're just not really sure what's happening there. Number five is Migdal Babel, the Dor HaPlaga, Dor HaPlaga, the story of dispersion, however you want to refer to it, the story of Migdal Babel. Number six, we get back to lineage again. So six, after we have already met the families of Shem, Chum, and Yafes, now we get from Shem down to Abraham. And finally, seven, we actually meet Abraham and Sarah, or then Abraham and Sarai, and we hear a very basic, very little information given, but we have a little bit of an introduction to Abraham and Sarah. Maybe next week we'll talk about why they don't seem to get the introduction that they deserve. You know, the story of the Kipshanaish, you would think that a story like that, so monumental, would make it into the Chumash if it happened. But that's its own discussion. Either way,
just want to see how much time.
Okay. So with that, so again, just one more time, we have the Mabul's one. Number two is Hashem's bris with Noach. Number three is Noach in the Karen, in the vineyard. Number four is the lineage of Shem, Chum, and Yafes. Number five is Migdal Babel. Number six is more lineage from Shem to Abraham, that was 10 generations. And number seven is the basic introduction that we get to Abraham. Okay. So first critical thinking question is, what's going on with Hashem and his decision making? Hashem seems very fickle. He seems to be changing his mind. Why, in fact, did Hashem destroy the world? And then why did he then decide to never do it again? Right. So that's the big question here. So I have to think about it.
I mean, in terms of why he decided to destroy the world, Rasan and Shine talked about in Yesodia Parsha on Monday night that because that mankind in that generation resolved not to be Adam anymore, that they resolved to be like a behemoth, that they wanted everything to be easy. So then Hashem said, then if you don't want to be an Adam, then there's no point in creation anymore. And that he quoted from the Maharal that Hashem removed one of the Asar Mamaros that he created the world, which is the Kavod Mamayim, and that's why the Mabul is sort of just like almost like a consequence of Hashem taking away something from creation.
Interesting. I wonder why he picked that one. I'm thinking out loud. Why did he pick that one? I know that David Foreman has an approach, and in one of his videos on Alpha Beta, he talks about how the world, when it was created, it was engulfed in water. You look in the first day one of creation, you see that the entire world is in water, and Hashem's destruction of the world was in the form of water, because this was Hashem's introduction to recreating the new world.
Yeah.
So that might explain it. I want to just look at it from the perspective. Now, one of the things you spoke about, I don't remember if I mentioned this last week or I just wrote it in the bar, so I don't remember if I said anything about it. But you look at what happened when Adam ate from the Eitz HaDa'as, and then he gained this concept of Da'as Tovara, which I've seen in some Sfarim, I've seen in the Or Gedalia, who it's the idea that there is now an Erbuvia, this mixture, Tov, Ra, there's an Or B'choshech Shev Adam, as Reb Chaim Shmulevitz writes about. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, he has in more than one piece of Sichas Moser, is titled Or B'choshech Shev Adam, that we have these conflicting drives, some for good, some for evil. Some are selfish and some are selfless. And this mixture, it's tolerable. You know, it's not the best, but it's tolerable. Man has drives pulling in both directions. And the Ramchal writes about it extensively in Derech Hashem, that Hashem created a man in such a way that he has the opportunity to do both good and bad. And if not for that opportunity to do both, then he can never attain his true level, his true dvekus, and get the ultimate pleasure of that for which Hashem created the world in the first place. So it's tolerable that this balancing act exists. But you get to the very end of Bereishis, right? Look in Matir of Bereishis, and what does the Chumash say? What does Hashem say? He says, "Vayakir Abar Stamart." What does Hashem say? "Vayomer Hashem." What Hashem said, but what Hashem sees. Right. On Rak Ra Kol Hayom, there was a certain point at which man had debased himself, and there was no semblance of him being willing to do any good. And this could be where Sanyatan was touching on as well. But this idea that there's Rak Ra Kol Hayom. Now, if you're going to tell me that that's why Hashem destroyed the world, then why does Hashem turn around later and say, "I'm never going to do this again"? Because if you go to what I put as section 2, Hashem's bris with Noah, which is but it's after the marble. I think it's in Perek. Is it Perek Tes? Yeah, it's in Perek. It's in Perek Ches, I actually think. Before the rainbow. Before rebuilding the new world, as the
art scroll,
as the art scroll Tanakh has it, When Hashem says he's not going to do it anymore, well, what does Lashon mean? Yeah, that's it. That's in Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Hashem says, "I'm not going to destroy the world anymore." Right? Lo asif lekal lo odas adam ba'avur ha'adam. Why? Ki yitzir lev ha'adam ra min urav. Because listen, his inclination is just so evil, you know, even from his youth. And now the question that we face is, I don't get it, because earlier. It's almost the exact same lashon. Why Hashem destroyed the world in the first place? Not fear of voracious. He says, Now he's saying, "Kiyetzer levat ma'aminuva." I destroyed mankind because he's evil. I'm not going to destroy mankind again because he is evil. So I know Rav Hirsch addresses this question. I heard this week that Rav Asher Weiss addresses this question. But again, the question itself is, it sounds like the same reason why Hashem destroyed the world is the same reason why he's not going to destroy the world again. Now, Pshat, what's happening? So there are different answers suggested, and this is a big question, famous question, again, as I mentioned at first, and I heard now Rav Asher Weiss suggest the answers. The answer revolves around, now we're getting caught up in the similarities between the two expressions, and we're not focusing on the difference. The difference is important. Rak rak olayom, right? Kietzer lev machshavos libo rak rak olayom. And versus kietzer lev adam ramin urav, there is a difference. Now, I want to suggest, just based on the pashup shot, what each of these phrases means is very important. On rak rak olayom is really an observation of what mankind has done and what mankind has demonstrated about his inclination. It's a very hopeless look at mankind, and it's looking at mankind and in terms of what he deserves. Al PMS, you know, mankind deserve to be destroyed. In an essay that I wrote, the way I referred to it, I said that the Chumash is describing. In fact, it says Vayar. This is what Hashem is looking at. This is not Hashem's declaration. Hashem's declaration is, I'm going to destroy mankind. Vayar, but what does he see? He sees, or Hashem is able to see the inclination of man. And not only that, Hashem is able to observe the actions of man. It's a very observable standpoint. It's coming from the standpoint of something that you can see.
That's it.
And you can assess just by looking at it. And, you know, in a court of law, so to speak, when the judge has to take the information that he has at face value, or at least, he has to hear the testimony. The testimony in this courtroom of the entire world, of mankind. So the odds were stacked against man because man does not have a really good excuse for what he did. And at the end of the day, there really is never really a good excuse to go against the Ratzon Hashem. So what does it mean? Ki yetzer lev adam ra min urav. Ra min urav sounds like what? Well, what does it literally translate to?
That he has this evil almost, like even from his youth, even when.
And therefore what?
And therefore that's going to be an excuse. So like when you get older and you're still ra, you could be like, yeah, but that's how I started out.
Okay, so in other words, this sounds like we're starting to cut slack for man, because after all, right before it's, I'm going to destroy man because after all he's evil. Now we're saying, I'm not going to destroy man because after all, his evil comes from his youth. You know, it's like Don the Kav's Chus. See where this man came from. See, all the things involved. After all, I gave him a Yetzirah, which made it very difficult for him. Yeah. And he had this, his Yetzirah had a head start over his Yetzirah Tov, because his Yetzirah is much more innate, it's much more natural, it's much more instinctive. And therefore, says Hashem, I'm going to start cutting some slack for mankind. Now, here's the problem. The problem is, where was this God at the end of Bereshit? Where was this? You know, this Rachmanas. You know, at the end of Bereshis. And you know, and it's very strange. So, in the essay that I wrote, I did what all the Mepharshim do in Parshas Noach, and I blamed it on Noach. Why did I blame it on Noach? So, the perspective that I was writing about, I was suggesting that Hashem's fickle nature in between Bereshis and Noach seems very human, and I wanted to argue that Hashem was actually working with a human sort of outlook, that Hashem was waiting for our human influence to kind of introduce the other perspective. Meaning, the question I just posed here was, where was the Hashem of Rachmanes in the end of Bereshis? Hashem is like changing his mind now, meaning, oops, I made a mistake before. What I did before was wrong. The response to that is no. What Hashem did before was not wrong. It was not wrong to destroy mankind. In fact, it was MS. It was Alpi Din, Alpi MS, man deserved to be destroyed. Is there room to be down the cosmos? Is there room to look at where, you know, you can cut slack for a man? I guess there always is, but in the court of law, that's not usually how it works. Right? Alpi Din, that's not how it works. But we know that when Hashem created the world, He created it with Din, the Shem Elokim. But when He created man, the Chumash tells us that it was Hashem Elokim. And what does Rashi tell us why Hashem Elokim? Because man could not exist
with just pure Din.
With just pure Din. And that's why the Midrash says Hashem took His seal of MS and He threw it down to the world. Once He threw it down to the world, that was Hashem's statement that really mankind needs, Rachmanis, mankind needs someone to be down the Kapskos for it. And I think this is where Noach comes in. Hashem, perhaps, you know, with all the Mepharshim, between the Zohar and the Chasam Levitz and the Al-Sheikh, and really all the Mepharshim, the big fault they have with Noach and the contrast from Abraham is whether or not he did either the right amount of Kiruv or he did the right amount of Tefillah for the people. Was he davening for them? Would davening have worked? Rav Chasam Levitz talked about that as well. But what's the point? The point is that Noach heard, just like Abraham heard, that the community was going to be destroyed. And Noach took that and just sat with that. Why? Why would Noach do such a thing? Well, Alpi Din, it makes sense. Was Noach supposed to argue? Well, apparently he was. Not to say that Hashem's Din was wrong, right? Hashem destroyed Sodom, Abraham argued, and Hashem said, I'm going to destroy it anyway. And that was the end of the conversation. Meaning sometimes Din wins out. But what if Hashem was waiting for a human influence to sort of say, wait, but what about Dan Lekavskos for mankind? And to give Rachmanis. And I think that's why at the very end, Noach didn't connect those dots. And that's why Hashem has to kind of tell him, after all, ki yetzer lev ma'adam rami nu'urach. You know, there was always room for that worldview of Rachmanis and Dalekavskos. So maybe Hashem was possibly waiting for a human to look at fellow humans and say, hey, we could have Rachmanis for them. But no human did that. And since no human did that, and by the time Mabo came, there was only one worldview of Din. No one thought to, you know, Noach, the only human, didn't think of the concept of Rachmanis. So maybe that's why the Mabo ultimately happened, and Hashem now had to say, okay, by the way, there's this other worldview that we can work with of Rachmanis.
I'm not sure if this is similar to what you're saying, but
find out in a second.
Right, stay tuned. It sounds kind of like to me right now, just looking at this for a couple of minutes, that the decision not to destroy the world isn't based on Yitzhak Yitzhak. It's based on a reaction to Noach's korban. And Hashem saw the Reach of Noach and said, I won't destroy the world. Okay, now I won't destroy the world. I need some sort of logic for that. Okay. What's that? Oh, ki yitzulev adam ra minura. That alone isn't a time. It doesn't say Hashem decided that since Lev adam ra minura, we won't destroy the world. Right? It's Hashem saw Noah's korban.
You're saying key, meaning
if you look at the in the one in Bereshit, right? It says Vayinachem Hashem. Rashi says it means Hashem changed on purpose for me to drachmim and me to din.
Yeah.
Right. And you could say that's connected to what you're saying that someone needs to daven and take it back to me to
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, thank you for pointing that Rashi out. Yeah.
thingy. So yeah, that's a way that it works in tefillah, or Pincus talks about this, that tefillah is not changing Hashem's mind. Tefillah is, there's a bunch of different tainas, and by adding your weight to one of them, right, by davening for a certain thing, that's sort of giving that taina more weight.
In fact, just before you continue, I just want to add that that we, in our Yom HaNarayim davening, so we have the famous piyut of V'chol Ma'aminim, that we say like shortly after the Zant Tokef and after Kedusha. And the, what's the line before V'chol Ma'aminim? Ha'oches v'yad mishpat. That he grabs in his hand mishpat. Now, I like writing essays, as you guys know. So I did write up a little piece on that line, ha'oches v'yad mishpat. And if I found out that what I wrote was similar to a Rashi and Hazinu, because the Lashon Hazinu, I figured, the Lashon of Ha'oches V'yad Mishpat probably was borrowed from Hazinu, because there's a Lashon there that the Chumash says. But it's slightly different order. It's towards the end of Hazinu. What's the Lashon there? If you find it before me, shout it out. Yeah, that's it. So Rashi over there basically says an idea that I thought of. He talks about how a human, when he throws an arrow, he can't get that arrow back. But Hashem, when he throws the arrow is mishpat. He's okay's biyad. That Hashem can always pull it back. And it's like an arrow on a string. He shoots the arrow, like the ice cream, flicker thing, and the ball flies off. So Hashem could pull it back as it's going. And we saw Hashem do this with the hailstones in Parshas Bo, the very end, right? The fiery hail, and when the stones that were on their way down, they went back up. But the idea of ha'oches v'yad mishpat, according to one pshat in Rashi, is that of course there's a midah of din, but that midah of din doesn't govern Hashem. Hashem governs it, so that if Hashem wants, Hashem can pull it back. And that's where, jumping back and forth between midas din, midas rachum, these are just all within Hashem's choice. What does Hashem want to do right now? Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, so you can continue your point.
So that's, I think, is along the lines of what I'm saying. It sounds like really the difference, and this is connected to what you were saying before, the difference really between Hashem's decision, I put little finger quotes, to change the world, to destroy the world, and then not to destroy the world, the difference was whether there was someone davening. Meaning at first, you're right, people think, and obviously you're right, the words are...
So Noach did an avoda, you're saying.
The korban, and Hashem saw the korban, said, okay, now we'll use the rachamim one. Mm-hmm. At first Hashem changed to the din one, maybe hoping someone would daven, maybe, I don't know. But no one did, right? Or no one did enough, so it didn't change. So it stayed at the mishpat. Mm-hmm. Now that Noach davened, it changed back.
Yeah, I think that's good, and I definitely think that helps.
So it's not that there's a new lesson here in Yetzirah Levadim, right, Ram and Urav.
Okay, so what?
It's not that there's a new lesson here or something new Hashem figured out. Hashem always knew both sides.
Oh, of course,
meaning,
I wasn't suggesting
I know,
that Hashem
didn't
know both
sides. I'm saying Hashem was introducing, favoring
he's,
one.
He's introducing...
So I'm saying that was there. And that's what that Rashi was saying in Bereishis. That was already there. But Hashem, that's Be'inachim, Hashem changed me to the din anyway. Hashem knew about that. That might have even been the initial status quo. And then Hashem changed me to the din. And that says, wait a minute, rock, got destroyed.
Introducing in terms of this is the first time we find that Lashon, this is the first time he's saying it to anybody.
Yeah, but Hashem had it and considered it and said, even so, we'll destroy the world. But now that Noach Davin, that brought that one back up. And that's why, and it's hard to understand in recording, but you see my hands in your arms.
I think that's very consistent. I think, yes, that this is what I said, when Hashem created the world, when he created man, he said, okay, man needs Rachman. Right. So then, and as you just said, he went off the chair of Rachman, he went onto the throne of him, and both worldviews existed simultaneously.
Right.
Okay. So that's on Hashem's decision-making process. Okay, this conversation now, this next critical thinking question is in honor of Ellie Bernstein, who I had a conversation with last night because we were discussing the crime of Chum. And really the crime of Chum in light of Rashi. Like Rashi, the Chumash is not so clear what he did. It says that he saw. Like, you know, that was his crime. He saw. It was a Shemira Sinayim issue. So Rashi says it was more than a Shemira Sinayim issue. The fact that he saw Noah naked in his tent, and he was drunk, and he told his brothers, and then the brothers, and Shem and Yefes, they covered him up. But Rashi tells us that when Noah wakes up, he sees what Chum had done. And according to the Gemara Sanhedrin, which Rashi quotes, that means he realized that Noah realized that Chum had done something to him. And he quotes two pshatim that either he was saraisim, he castrated him, or he was roveya, and he sodomized him. So even though the term sodomize is really anachronistic, because that we learned that from Sodom, but either way you get the idea. So the first question is, you know, where do you get that from, that he did such a thing? So Ellie and I found in the Shari'ara yesterday that it's based on Xereshava Vayar Vayar, that we find that it says, so Vayar Chama Viknanis Ervas Aviv, and we also find Vayar Osa Shchem Ben Chamor. Shchem saw Dina, so we have Vayar Vayar. And who's the Shara I'm quoting on this? That might be in the Gemara, actually, in Sanhedrin. That might be part of the Gemara. So, now, I think more evidence, by the way, the fact that it says that he saw the erva of his father. If you look in Achron Moshe Midoshim, you know, you might say this is a stretch, right? It's a stretch to say that he was Boel his father. But just to put it into context, how do you know that? Like, are we just being a mitzaref, a re'iyah to a maisa to say that he did it? How? Like, what's your evidence that he did it? So I think it at least adds to the conversation. If you look at Achrei Mos and Kedoshim, when we're told about all the Arayos, the Lashon that's used is Megala Arayos, right? Just to reveal it, or in this case, to be exposed to it. So the fact that Noach was exposed, and then we have Chum doing something, even if the Lashon is just Re'iyah, that can be, you know, it's not even Mitzarev to Maisa, but it's just, you know, it's kind of like fill in the blanks. What happened? Now, big part of the question then is, what would have motivated Chum to do such a thing? To castrate him, we kind of understand, because the Rashi fills that in for us. What would be the benefit of castrating his father?
No more kids
for Noach, and then therefore what? What would Chum get out of that?
More inheritance.
That
the world.
Yeah, the world. Yeah, his inheritance was a huge inheritance, right? Noach's will was a really big, fat will, which says, you know, the entire world is yours. So a third of the world would then go to Chum. Now, the other big question is, what did Canaan do? So Rashi has to fill in the blanks, and Rashi says that, oh, well, Canaan told Chum about this. But there's more. The Tosfos in Sanhedrin, which the Shari'aron quotes, Tosfos says, you know why he says, why didn't he curse Chum? Why did he curse Canaan instead? Like, why Bedafka did he not curse Chum? He says, Chum was already bound by a blessing. By Baruch Lekim Es Noach Ves Banav. So because Hashem had already blessed him, so the Ein Klala B'Makom Bracha, so therefore he needed to, you know, the curse had to manifest itself in a slightly different way. Now you might ask the question, okay, why does Canaan have to suffer? Well, then that the Midrash answers that is that Canaan was somehow involved. But either way, the Chumash and the Mefarshim account for that. But the point that was really bothering Ellie, which should be bothering all of us, is what would have been Chum's motivation for being Roveya his father? What would that have done? I think I heard maybe a shot that he was almost trying to traumatize his father, so to speak, that his father would not engage in relations if he had done such a thing to him after experiencing something like that. But exactly what would, you know, what would have possessed Chum to do such a thing? To say that he merely had lust and he needed to get a release, that I don't think is pasha at all, because there are other ways to get a release. Chum had a wife. And you know,
and kids.
He had a wife, he had kids. Exactly. Very, very, very good points. So he had a wife, he had kids, and you know, when you need a release, you don't just say, okay, where's the next person I could find who's vulnerable? Oh, my father, perfect. No one really thinks that way. Now, there's that question. Then the question that I asked in the critical thinking questions along with this is, did Chum's punishment fit the crime? So, well, what was Chum's punishment exactly? Well, what was Noah's curse to Chum or to Chum's progeny? What does he say? Pasuk Chav Hey.
Eved Avadim
Yad Echad. He's gonna be an Eved. So, I wasn't originally planning to go in this direction, but this came to mind. To quote another idea from the Rabbi David Foreman, the second is also in one of his Parsha videos, but he talks about the parallels between this scene and Adam and Chav and Gan Eden. There are a lot of parallels. I'm not going to go through this entire Arichus. Basically, he puts Noach in the place of God, in a sense, but Noach is also in the place of Adam. Noach is kind of playing a dual role, because Noach is the one who's giving out curses, just like Hashem did. Noach planted a vineyard, just like Hashem planted Gan Eden. Hashem planted the trees. But Noach is kind of trying to a little bit play the role of God, and he kind of messes up in doing that. But we find the concept of nakedness in both scenes. We find the concept of being aware of your eyes being opened and seeing your nakedness. We find this in both stories. And if you look, so when Noach's curse to Chum a little bit resembles Hashem's curse about the concept of, you know, the concept, or at least the concept of subservience, right? Chum is going to be subservient. He's going to be a subordinate. Kind of like when Hashem told Chava, your husband is going to dominate you, right? But if we're trying to get figure out a rationale why Chum would rape his father, so this is true with real, you know, with regular rape of women. People who rape women, I believe modern studies show that it's not just because they needed a release. Part of rape culture, when I say rape culture, I don't mean Stam and the Me Too movement where, you know, everything is rape. What I mean is like real rape. In real rape, you know, the goal is not always just because next person you saw, you needed this person. But part of it is that a rapist appreciates the feeling of dominance. He wants to dominate the other person. And this is really where Chum was coming from. He, whether you say he castrated or raped his father or did both, what does Chum want? Chum wants to be just like, you know, Adam and Chav and Gan Eden. They wanted to be independent. They wanted to be like God. They wanted to be in charge. Chum's dominating of his father represents that betrayal of your creator, so to speak. Just like Adam and Chav, they betrayed Hashem. So Chum betrays his own father. He says, I'm going to dominate my father. And what's his punishment? You're going to be an Eved, or your children are going to be Avadim. You think you're going to inherit the world? Well, guess what? Koma shekana Eved kana rabba. Everything that Chum's progeny are going to get, or at least Canaan, is going to go to their master. And now we kind of understand a little bit what's happening here with Chum and why he would do such a thing. You know, even though obviously it's still very difficult because it's such an extreme thing to do. But this gets us a little bit into the head of Chum and to understand exactly what the problem with Chum was. Okay. Any questions before we move on to the final topic?
I was wondering if you could say it does seem like the Pasuk, just from reading the Pasuk, right,
yeah,
doesn't really focus on the whatever it is that he did, right? But more the fact that I guess he saw something, but also that he told his brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just thinking maybe part of that, like, why would he rape his father or even castrate his father, right? It doesn't seem to be the key point. The key point seems to be he did it and told his brothers. So you could even say that right now there's like four men like living in the world, right? And Chum just made sort of, similar to what you're saying, but he made sort of a power move and told everybody about it. Like, he, you know, how he probably expected people to see him is like a little unpredictable and like strong and like someone you don't want to mess with, right? Because like,
so I like I very much like what you're saying, and I want to take it a step further. What practically was Chum accomplishing when he did what he did? He was Megale Arayos. He was Megale Erva.
Right.
His father's Erva.
Right.
Now, Chum saw it. His brothers didn't see it. And he was being Megale to his brothers.
Right.
And they covered up the father's Erva. But he was trying to, he was exposing. And that, even if he didn't actually rape him, that's he violated his father.
Right.
Even if he didn't actually rape him, even if he didn't actually castrate him, if you want to say it's pshat or not pshat, but he violated his father. And that's the point, that whatever he did, he violated his father.
Right.
For that. Okay, so this point we spoke about last year, but I want to speak about it again, and that is, what was the sin of the Dor HaFlaga, the Dor HaPalaga, the Migdal Bava? What did they do wrong? Why did Hashem need to intervene? Right, so we know Rashi quotes three pshatim in the Midrash that are all basically similar. But, you know, and what are we taught from when we're kids? And because it's a Midrash, so, you know, it's fair game. But what are we always taught? What were they trying to do?
Reach the heavens and fight with God.
Right. So yeah, and it seems very odd, and it makes you wonder. Let's go with the war on God approach, right? Which is the first one that Rashi quotes. So why did Hashem need to intervene? Could we simulate what would have happened if Hashem didn't intervene?
You know, keep on going.
They would keep on going. They would die in the atmosphere. This is exactly what I said last year. They reach outer space and they would die.
Right.
Or maybe they wouldn't build it so high. Maybe they would build it up to the clouds and they would be like
really cold.
Yeah, or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a stupid idea if it's a war on God, and Hashem should just let them build their stupid tower and not do anything. So I'm not saying that they weren't doing a war on God. I'm saying you have to answer the question, why did Hashem feel the need to intervene? And the second shot in Rashi, and the third, I'll get to in a little bit. But it's very strange. Before I go, I'll come back to the second and third shot in Rashi. I just want to direct your attention to Rav Sacks's Yama Mikedem on Bereishis and Noach, just because we should know that there are other pshatim here. He has a whole piece called Chet Amshal Anshei Dor HaPalaga. So he has a whole piece devoted to what was their sin, and he quotes a few pshatim. But the basic pshat that I'm going to quote from, that which he puts here, it's the pshat of the Rashbats, the Abarbanel, and the Ran. They all say that there wasn't actually an explicit chait that was done. They say that it was a knesiyah shelo l'shem shemayim. Right? And what's the rule about a knesiyah shelo l'shem shemayim? What does Pirkei Avos tell us? It's not destined to endure. So, and that's exactly what happened. And they say that, you know, Hashem just took it apart because it wasn't l'shem shemayim. And the Ran specifies there was no sin in Maisa or even in Machshava, but there was a dangerous hashkafa. And I think this hashkafa is actually going to come back to the other pshatim that I'll talk about in Rashi. And those are as follows. The other pshat in Rashi was this is based on the Lashon of Devarim Achadim, that they were trying to challenge Hashem's Yichud in the world. Challenging Hashem's oneness. That's pshat number two, which I don't think is so different from pshat number one, which is the war on God. It could be explaining the war on God pshat a little bit. But, does anybody have Rashi in front of them?
Yeah.
Okay, so you have that Rashi?
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, thank you. Shkaya? So, the third shot, which I think the third shot is my favorite. I almost see each shot is building on the previous one. Right, for shot number one is that they were going to do a war on God. And it could be, you know, from a simple perspective, it seems very odd. Hashem should have just let it happen. There was no reason for Hashem to get involved. Just let them build their stupid tower. Shot number two, they were challenging Hashem's oneness, which could explain shot number one. Shot number three, Amru, they said, Achas le'elef v'tuf resh nun vav shanim, every 1,656 years, Parakia mismotate kishem shasavime mabul. The firmament kind of breaks out, just it breaks down just like it did in the time of the mabul. Bo venasalo smochos, we're going to make supports for it. Right, and that's Rashi. So, and all from the Bereishis Rabbah. But what's the point? The point is, they were saying we're going to prevent another mabul from coming. Very fascinating. Now, Hashem's intervention for this is also strange. Why? Well, according to this pshat, and by the way, where did they get that number from?
The fact that the first mabul happened
in that year.
You calculate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I wasn't sure last year when I did Parshas Noach and Eitan Adler, one of our avid listeners still up in Eretz Yisrael now, but he mentioned that that was the year that the mabul took place in. So they made a calculation. Now why would Hashem need to? It's strange that Hashem would need to intervene even for that reason, because. Well, what are they saying? Oh, don't worry. When the next mabul comes, we're going to be ready.
No more mabul.
There isn't going to be another mabul. Hashem said there isn't going to be another mabul. So Hashem shouldn't have to intervene for that reason, right?
They're believing in science.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. So this, I have to show you my essay after this. Another essay that I wrote. They accepted the science of their times. I'm going to call you back. They accepted the science of their time that suggested that, in fact, there was a mabul. This was a tradition that they had from the past 10 generations, at least. They believed what they were told from their father, from their great-grandfather Noah and Shem. They all believed that a mabul happened. But which part of the mabul did they deny? They denied the religious moral part of it, where, it was because of Averos and because God, and it's not going to happen again because God said it's not going to happen. What were they, what in turn does that mean? They were denying God. They were saying, yes, Mabul, yes, science, yes, history, but no God. No morals, no religion. And this cuts to the core of what exactly was wrong with the Dor HaMabul, and their chet, was really, the truth is, it wasn't really a moral chet. It wasn't a moral chet. It was a religious chet. There's a difference in moral and religion, right? The moral they seem to pretty much have, and in an established, affluent community. You know, we would hope that people would be moral, right? Modern society, with the technological advancements, and the human has the capacity to be a very moral being. But their problem was a religious problem. It was a hashkafic problem. And this is what they were denying. This was the war on God. This is the challenge of God's yichud in the world. The challenge of even the existence of God. They would build a tower. Right, and this goes back to what they would accomplish during the war. Would they reach space and die? I don't think they would go that far because that would hurt them. But what would they do? They would build a tower so high, and they would get up to the clouds and then say, "Hey, there's no man in a white beard and a white cloak here. There must be no God." And they would effectively win the war on God. They would effectively disprove God. They would effectively pull the rug out from under religion and say that, listen, with modern science, look what we're able to do. And this is their whole thing. We're not selling new shame. We're going to make a name for ourselves. Right? And this is where we get to the problem of peer-reviewed research and groupthink. Right? In the academic world, people think that if you have a research paper that was peer-reviewed by enough people, so then you can establish it as legitimate. Now, I actually saw a case where there was a recent story. Could you pause it? So the case that I saw was that basically some people wrote a bunch of bogus articles. Research articles that were fake researches, and it kind of meshed with certain politics. So they were passed off as real, but they were admittedly fake. But the point is that they thought that if they worked together, they would be able to concoct a reality where man, the power of man, this is what the story is about, the power of man. And this is effectively what the war on God is. Now, why does God have to intervene? So this is the big thing. When man is in charge and man now creates the moral standard, eventually you can become a Dvar HaMabul again. Because if there's no religion, at the end of the day, you know, if there is no Yiras Shemayim, then there's no real morals. Morals can't survive. And if man is making all the decisions, then there's no more hope. So anyway, that's why Hashem had to intervene. Hashem said, you know, your achdus is nice, but you have to start again. We have to just start it all over again. They can't be under the impression that they have all of the control. Okay. So that just to wrap it up, we have number one is the Mabul, number two is Hashem's bris with Noach, number three is Noach in the vineyard, four is the lineage of Shem, Chaman, Yafes, number five is Migdal Bavel, number six is the lineage from Shem till Avram, the 10 generations, and finally number seven is meeting Abraham and Sarah. We get that little introduction to them. We'll speak more about them next week in Parashas Lech Lecha. Everyone have a wonderful Shabbos.
Yeah, you too.